Dear Asian Girl, for Asian girls, by Asian girls.
Welcome to Dear Asian Girl. We are so excited you're here for this special episode. This is Lindsay, podcast manager and guest co-host for our interview with Marissa Tantrum. Just a quick note at the top, I will be popping in throughout the episode just to give some quick explainers on things people at home may not be as familiar with regarding some Hollywood industry jargon, stats, and the like. Excited to dive in. Enjoy the show.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Dear Asian Girl. This is Isabel Leong, an 18-year-old Burmese-Vietnamese college student based in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and originally from Massachusetts.
Hi, everyone. This is Naina speaking. I am a 17-year-old girl based in Singapore currently, but I've grown up most of my life in Los Angeles, California. Currently, I'm in my senior year of high school taking the IB program, and yeah.
And hello, everyone. I am Lindsay, your podcast manager at Dear Asian Girl. You may remember me from last episode of this season where we discussed some of my experiences as a writer in Hollywood thus far. And I could not be more excited to introduce to you our guest today, Marissa Tantrum, a powerhouse screenwriter, showrunner, producer, musician, mother, and a truly incredible Asian woman for whom I am so grateful and who has absolutely inspired me in my career journey and many, many others. I have a personal connection to Marissa. I mentioned in the last episode that I previously got the opportunity to be a writer's production assistant and then a showrunner's assistant during the last two seasons of Marvel's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. And Marissa, as the showrunner, alongside her husband, Jed Whedon, and my previous boss, Jeff Bell, interviewed me for this position at Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., which was Marvel's flagship and also longest running TV series. And I will just personally add, the best TV series to date. It was also incredibly groundbreaking in its diversity, both in front of and behind the camera, for all 7 years that it was on air, which Marissa absolutely spearheaded and championed. Marissa is one of few Asian female showrunners in the business. And not to embarrass you, Marissa, but I did just want to give our listeners a sense of your accomplishments and backgrounds up to this point. Marissa began her journey in entertainment at the age of 12 in a Motown girl group, which still boggles my mind. She literally toured with Boys to Men, you guys. She wrote theater plays while studying at Occidental College, then started working as a TV writer in her 20s. With her now husband, Jed, she wrote the 2008 online musical phenomenon that was Dr. Horrible's sing-along blog, as well as for the TV series Dollhouse and Spartacus: Gods of the Arena. And then, of course, she was a showrunner on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. for all 136 episodes, 7 seasons, a behemoth accomplishment that now more than ever is incredibly rare and worth celebrating. So that brings us to me no longer speaking. Thank you so much, Marissa, for being here. We are ecstatic to be sharing this space with you.
Oh my goodness, thank you so much for having me. And oh my God, I hope I can live up to that intro. I never feel impressed with myself. So thank you very much for saying all those things.
As everything kept being listed, I was like, oh my gosh, like, yeah. Yes. Oh my gosh.
When you guys were introducing yourselves, I was like, oh, they're way cooler than I have ever been or ever will be.
No way.
Yes. Oh my gosh, yeah.
And as Lindsay mentioned, you've had such a range of credits in your career, and we're so interested in hearing how you first came to writing. As Lindsay mentioned, we know at age 12, you were part of the Motown girl group Pretty in Pink, which is so fascinating, by the way. Did you start your career believing you'd be in music? And if so, when did you know that you had an interest in pursuing writing?
I feel like I started journaling at a very early age. I think I was 7 or 8 years old. As soon as I was able to really fully form sentences and understand what, you know, the format of a paragraph is, I definitely found that journaling was a nice retreat for myself. Lindsay and I have spoken about this, just growing up in an Asian family, as an Asian American child, so sort of straddling both worlds, your commitment to family, and also just culturally, there are so many similarities that all us Asian Americans have experienced, but specifically Asian American girls have experienced. You're supposed to be good, quiet most of the time. Your voice is not necessarily totally welcomed if it is in opposition to what your parents are saying or want you to do. So I do think that journaling was a place for my voice that I found very early on. So whether or not I understood that that's something I wanted to do for the rest of my life, I don't think I understood that at the time, but it was definitely like a mode of really coming into myself at that age. And I'm very grateful for that. And now in retrospect, I realize that that's how it started. But with all of that said, I was a very busy kid and also showed that I had natural rhythm and groove when I was about 5 years old.
Yes,
and so my mom and dad enrolled me in just dance classes because they had me very young. She was 20 when she had me and he was 25. And so they were still sort of in the party mode. And so they would blast soul music, R&B music, disco, and that's how they would rock me to sleep. So I think it just sort of became a part of my DNA, or it was already a part of my DNA because it's part of theirs. So then I just started dancing really early on. So the dancing sort of led to singing, led to acting and auditioning. And then I auditioned a lot as a child. And so the singing group was one of my auditions, and it was mostly because they wanted an Asian girl who could dance, like hip hop dance. And I was very good at it, and I could hold a tune, but it wasn't necessarily something I was confident in. And the rest is history. Yeah. You say that Pretty in Pink is a fascinating time in my life. It's fascinating and also very incriminating.
Honestly, that's like, I think, all of our attitudes towards our youth, incriminating, but also hopefully blissful and enriching. So we've established clearly you've had great dance skills stemming from your childhood, and maybe the things you're talking about, like the shame you held throughout the time struggling with your identity, maybe this also either came along with you or changed or evolved during your college years. But we know that you wrote theater plays while you were studying at Occidental College in Los Angeles. Can you tell us a bit about your experience and how it influenced your identity and your passions as both an artist and a writer? And did your time in theater help you solidify what you want to do in your career?
One huge event that impacted my life and one of the main reasons why I focused on schooling again and going to college was I was diagnosed with lupus at 15, and my whole world had changed. So, you know, throughout the singing group, I'm very obviously relying on my physical capabilities, and I was very focused on that. I was very focused on the superficial qualities of myself, my presence on a stage, and my body being able to move and do whatever I needed it to do. And that came to a very sudden halt right in the middle of touring. And so as much as lupus has been pretty much a lifelong challenge, I do look at it as a blessing, because I believe that's when my shift happened, my shift of really taking a moment to reflect on who I am, what I want my life to look like. And it started at that time. And so, yes, at Occidental College is where I discovered my love of screenwriting, playwriting, putting things on the stage. And it was a way to combine all the things that I had loved and grew up with. So the element of performance was still there, because I double majored in English literature and theater. So my time was split between all my writing and English courses and also writing for the theater and doing musicals and plays and writing plays. And also the people that I became friends with, that was the beginning of me starting to embrace my identity and who I am as a Thai American. Because I met other, you know, in college you have all those groups, the affinity groups that you can be a part of, and the clubs and everything, and that's where it started for me. And so I wrote a play that was more so based on the intensity of a relationship between mother and daughter. But when I'm not sure if I was aware of the specificity of an Asian American daughter's experience mm-hmm. at the time. But when I look back at it, it's very interesting to reflect back on old writing and stuff and to really see your journey and not only who you are as a writer, your journey of like your writing evolving over time, but just who you were at the time to who you are now.
As mentioned, Marissa became a showrunner, and we're about to delve into what she told us about her time in a writer's room. Just to break it down for those who may not know, a TV writer's room consists of both writers and assistants at different levels. While the room is actively writing a show, collaborating to organize the outlines for each episode and the larger series and character arcs for the season, there is a general hierarchy. This starts with the showrunner, or head writer at the top, who is the captain of the ship, if you will, overseeing decision-making throughout the entire production process, as well as the writer's room itself. Then there is anywhere from a few to sometimes 10 to 15 writers working together at various levels beneath and with the showrunners. From there, there's usually a writer's assistant whose job it is to transcribe all the major points of discussion throughout the day. And while all the writers are collaborating together, each episode is assigned only to one writer or a writing pair to then go off and write their episode independently. On a TV show, there are a few other types of assistant roles. There are PAs, or production assistants, which is the role that I had. In a writer's room specifically, there might be one or two production assistants who are tasked with running errands, grabbing lunch, performing administrative duties, and ensuring the office is running smoothly. There is also usually an assistant per every showrunner who helps manage their calendars and responsibilities. Writer's PAs are separate from the set PAs, who work specifically on the television or film set, and whose job entails a wide variety of tasks, from relaying instructions between the director to the cast and crew, to escorting actors and extras to their required locations, assisting camera crew, preparing the set, etc. Okay, back to the show.
So we know from there, Marissa, that you did sell a script in your 20s. And my understanding is that you've been an assistant, you've been a staff writer, obviously ultimately a showrunner, meaning you've really held all of the positions that are present in a writer's room. Mm-hmm. Could you tell us more about your journey from being assistant to staff writer to head writer? And do you feel like this experience of working your way up allows you to better understand and empathize with the people on your team and thus be able to work with them more effectively?
Absolutely. I think my experience going from, I started off at Stephen Botchko Productions fresh out of college. I knew I wanted to start working right away. And quick shout out to my dad. My dad had worked.
Tommy T.
he was a transportation coordinator at the time. And he had worked his way up over the years as just a set driver to a cast driver and working his way up the sort of ladder in that department to becoming, you know, the head of transportation for every blockbuster feature, you name it. Those, you know, highly credited and accomplished directors had my dad on speed dial. And so he sort of had his, you know, his hands in the business and had so many connections as far as helping to get me a job in production. So a little bit of nepotism, but I'm not ashamed of it. I was like, my immigrant father worked his way up in this business.
Yeah,
yes, I'm gonna use his connections.
You gotta use the nepotism where we can.
Yeah. We're already starting off on a further foot, so yeah.
Yeah, exactly. He was really good friends with a line producer for one of Stephen Botchko's shows, another Chinese-American, awesome guy named Stephen Lim, and they were looking for a PA. And I started off as the corporate PA because Stephen Botchko had so many shows going at the same time, and so he had this office on the Fox lot. I feel like my whole writing career started at the Fox lot. And so I was the best, in my mind, I was the best corporate PA there was. And that meant stocking the fridge with so much gusto. I would turn the labels of the soda cans perfectly forward. You know, all of my kind of OCD perfectionist tendencies came out in the way I delivered the lunches. I knew, like, it wasn't ultimately what I wanted to do with the rest of my life, but I knew that if I show excellence in this area, in my job currently, then the people around me, I was in an environment where people would notice and want to know more about me and understand what my goals and dreams were. And that's exactly what happened. And I worked my way up. I became Mark Tinker's assistant, and he was a producing director on NYPD Blue. And so I was able to go to set with him, understand what his role was as a director. David Milch understood that I wanted to be a writer. He read some of my plays that I wrote at Occidental College, and he was an incredible mentor, and talk about learning from the best of the best. So I was exposed to the process in the writer's room there. So I really, really took the opportunity to immerse myself in all aspects of production. At the time where I was young and had more energy, despite the lupus, I, you know, had to be mindful always. But, you know, when you're young in your 20s and you're wide-eyed and bushy-tailed and the whole world is, like, still all out there in front of you, I was like, what else can I do? Can I go from set to the room? What do you need? What do you need? Do you need, I don't know, do you need me to refresh your ice in your drink while you sit on the floor breaking story? I'll do it all. So I was very hungry to learn, and I think, you know, it definitely benefited me and my path. And I think, you know, the way the industry is structured now, with limited episode amounts and limited seasons per show, there isn't as much opportunity to work your way up from a PA to, you know, being in the room as a writer's assistant. Like Lindsay, in the short time you were with us in the last few years of S.H.I.E.L.D., it was, you know, but I, as a person who have come up that way, I was very conscious of, she can go there, she can go there and learn from Belle. And
I absolutely did. It was so exciting. And it was such an honor because, as I said, I got to be there for the last couple seasons. So it was such a well-oiled machine. I just was so impressed. And exactly as Marissa said, it was like, you know, from stocking the fridge to then answering phone calls to then truly, you guys really extended that invitation to please be immersed in every way you want to be. Please be curious in every way you want to be. Go to set, spend as much time as you want and can, you know, seize your opportunity. And that invitation vocalized from you and from Jeff and Jed was just like, it was life-changing. And I really appreciate it because I really did feel like a sponge. Every day I got to soak up like this behemoth, like, company, this ship, you know, with all these different roles. And it was just so awesome.
Yes. And I'm glad that you took advantage of it and understood what kind of opportunity that was. Because I do think now a lot of people don't, in the culture of social media and internet accessibility, where you feel like, well, I don't want to waste my day being an assistant, I'd rather just like make something on my own or write and sit at a coffee shop all day long and wait for that opportunity to happen. Mm-hmm. You can do both. You can do both. You can, the benefit of actually taking an assistant job or a PA job is that you are now in an environment where there are people around you that will take an interest in you and actually help you out. You're in an environment, there's nothing better than the firsthand experience. You can read about production all you want. If you're not actually sitting there and soaking it in and seeing how every department head works. And I think one of the things that I'm the most proud of on S.H.I.E.L.D. is that so many of our writers, like I would say, yeah, by the time we reach season 6 and 7, like half of our staff were former assistants.
Absolutely.
Who worked their way up. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And granted, we had 7 years to give those opportunities. And that's the beauty of the rare gem of a situation that we had. That kind of, you know, there's it doesn't happen as much anymore, and I find that very unfortunate. Yeah.
100%. I'm also curious, you know, what were some of the lessons along the way that gave you the confidence to eventually lead a room and know that you were supposed to be there? Obviously, many of us wrestle with imposter syndrome. A lot of women do, you know, so I can imagine it being a bit nerve-wracking when you were first starting out and maybe still developing your confidence in these spaces.
Oh, yes. I don't think imposter syndrome ends. And I do think that's part of being an artist. I mean, at least for me, I'll say that it might be different for other people, and more power to you. But I think a common aspect of a writer's path is to never quite, you know, writing it's a very vulnerable process. And I think people who actually want to embark on that are people who, you know, it's like you put yourself on the page because that's still safer than leaving. Than, you know Amen. What I mean? It still feels like, okay, well, part of me is here on this paper and I'm going to hand it over and maybe like scurry into the corner and wait and see what they actually think about it. Yeah, but I was talking to my sister-in-law, Eliza Clark. She was the showrunner and creator of Why the Last Man. She adapted Why the Last Man. And she is a prolific playwright, writer. She's a voracious reader. She just, she writes constantly. But she now has this, I guess for lack of a better word, it's not a blog, it's a newsletter or something that she's publishing now called Witches Marked by Eliza Clark. And she speaks about the writing process and how painful it is for her every time, and how no matter what she's writing, she'll start and it's always like a seven-step process of doubting everything that goes onto the page for six steps, and then finally reading it and being like, oh, it's not so bad. Maybe I can do this with my life, actually, and I don't have
to. Totally. I know I mentioned this to Naina and Isabel when we had our last conversation of just like, it can be a very lonely existence. So much of your world becomes very interior because who's holding yourself accountable? You. Who's having the conversations with oneself? You know, and who's celebrating your wins, which might just be writing a couple pages or, you know, whatever like metric you're setting up for yourself. It's really just you. And so it can be crazy making, it can be incredibly gratifying, but it can be a struggle. And I think no writer would negate that.
Right. Once you actually get in the groove, then there's no better feeling. And then when you finally finish, you feel like, okay, I can retire now that you finished, you know, you finished a short story and you're like, okay, I'm done. I did it. But I will say back to your question about confidence in the room and running a room. I'm not sure if it's ever there, but ever there at the level that you know, ideally want it to be. Yes, of course, with time, you acquire more wisdom and you understand what your job is. And so you feel a bit more settled in that, but there's always trepidation. So if you feel that way, just know you're not alone. And I think for me, my experience is that my partner is also my life partner, my husband. And a huge part of that had to do with when we first met, I was on my TV writing path and my screenwriting path. And we started dating right after I was working on Oliver Bean. And through that job, I signed a little development deal with Fox. And Quan Fung, who was a Fox executive at the time, he was a big champion for Asian voices and storytelling at the time, where it was not as welcomed as it is today, or not as embraced as it is today. Right now, what is happening, I never thought I'd see the day. And yes, of course, there's still room for improvement. But I mean, across the board, the movies, the TV shows that are getting recognized and acknowledged that have Asian faces in them, in front of the camera and behind, I kind of never thought this day would come, and I'm so glad it's here. But at the time, it was like, let's do an Asian American family sitcom, and can the dad be accented, and can just the run of the mill drill. And I think I was so stressed out and unhappy that I started getting very sick. And so Jed was there, obviously, seeing all of this. And he was like, well, let me help you. What do you need? Do you want to bounce jokes around? And that's kind of how our partnership started, because he is from a family of writers. Like, he's a third generation TV writer. And so he just has that natural gift. He wasn't pursuing it at all at the time. He was a musician.
Really?
No, he was in a band. That's how we met. We met through music. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
He grew up with Jesse Botchko, Stephen Botchko's son, and he was working as a messenger at the time. Because he was supplementing his band life. And so he would come in. At the time, it was still like messengers in person. There was no like emailing scripts. It was, you hand the document.
Wow.
That's how old we are. That's how old. But he would come in, and his guitarist was also a PA at Botchko. And he said, you know, she could sing, and we need a girl. We need female vocals on this track. And so that's how I met. I sang background on his
album. What a beautiful love story. My God.
Yeah.
These multi-hyphenates who can do everything together. That is crazy.
It's crazy. And so while I was doing my pilot development and I was having a hard time, we started bouncing, and I was like, you know, we should write a feature together and just see how that, let's write a feature and see what happens. And we did, and it sort of went out wide, and we started doing the meetings, and then the strike happened. And then, but of course, out of that, Dr. Horrible was born. And then it just all kind of,
everything plays out how it's meant to.
Yeah.
And speaking of Dr. Horrible, we wanted to ask you about whether, especially earlier in your career, if you faced pressure from studios or peers or people in general to portray Asians in a certain way. If you ever encountered situations where you were asked to portray Asians stereotypically or as like the butt of the joke. For listeners, we just have to add, all of us watched the song Nobody's Asian in the Movies from Dr. Horrible's sing-along blog, which we highly recommend. It was hilarious. I loved it. But it was also so tragically true. How you address the only roles in the movies for Asians have so often been as the geek or the old wise man or physician. So we're just curious how you navigated these situations early on in your career.
Well, it's so, acting has always been a love of mine as well. And I was pursuing that during college and right after college. So I would go out on auditions when I could. And I would always get to the point where it was always for the sidekick. It was never for a lead role. And again, remember, I'm an older person. So while I was pursuing this, it was still Asians. People of diverse backgrounds were always relegated to being the dressing.
Yeah.
So every part I would audition for, if I got to the point of testing, I would be sitting in a room. It would be me, a Black girl, and a Hispanic girl.
Mm-hmm.
And it would always go to the roles would always go away from me.
Mm-hmm.
And so after some time, I was just like, you know what? I'm not going to do this anymore. It's stressful. It's making me sick. I'm just going to focus on my writing. I still love to do it. And, and even to this day, I find myself acting in things that I have written. I've appeared on different, shows. And it's always small things, but it's still so fun to sort of you know, flex that muscle here and there and remember that there's a love of play in all aspects of things, and that I still can do that when I want to do it. So I will say that it was very disheartening at the time where I was really trying to focus on being an Asian woman in front of the camera, as well as like my first staff job on Oliver Bean. I was the only minority. I was the only woman. I was the youngest. And I was in a room full of comedy writers, which was a different experience for me. My assistant experience was on drama shows. So it was a definite shock to the system, and I had to learn really fast. And I wouldn't say I met some great people there, but I wouldn't say it was my most favorite experience. I definitely felt alone and isolated and not heard.
I think in a comedy room especially, right, the dynamic is so distinct. I don't want to use the word like ruthless, but I think to be able to have that interpersonal strong bond that I'm sure that a lot of these men probably had, and then to come out in there othered from the beginning when you're pitching jokes all day, I can imagine being very stressful and alienating.
And every writer's room has an element of that, right? It's about, but especially in a comedy room, it's about sort of one-upping each other and who has the best joke, who will get the biggest laugh. And, you know, to be fair, it wasn't all just the environment. I was definitely out of my element. So any sort of insecurities I have were just exacerbated by the fact that I just felt in the minority, which I was. I probably could have done a much better job had I not been feeling so aware of how I was the only one all the time.
Absolutely.
But, you know, these are all part of your education as a person, as a writer. And so I don't regret anything. I feel like everything in my life has happened as it should be and as it should have. And so, yeah, as my daughter says, she says, I hate lupus. And then she says, well, I don't hate it because there's so many parts of it that's made you who you are and it's part of your personality. She goes, I just don't like when it hurts you.
Benny.
I know, Benny Bean.
That's so sweet.
Yeah.
It's so precious.
I know.
Gosh. Well, speaking of, you know, advocating for more dimensional and diverse representation, you have shared in the past, perhaps jokingly or not, that your secret goal was to get all Asian faces on screen during Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., and which I love. And as we shared, it famously became one of the most diverse TV shows on air at the time. Can you talk to us about what this process looked like and how your mission was received by executives at the time? Did you encounter roadblocks? And if so, did that evolve with time as the show became so obviously successful?
Yes, there were roadblocks. There were so many roadblocks with that show because people wanted it to succeed, and it was the first of its kind. As you said before, it was Marvel's first live-action television series, and then with all of the Marvel history and the, you know, vast encyclopedia of characters, people had high expectations. And so because of that, roadblocks emerged because there were many cooks in the kitchen. So when it came to casting, yes, I was like, there at least has to be one Asian person in the cast. And then that sort of evolved into, well, I think we can have two. and if they're not Asian, like we should have, you know, my mission was clear. It wasn't at all a secret mission, but when it came to Agent May, I think people might know this story, but originally the character's name was Agent Rice. And it was supposed to be, you know, a very strong Black woman was the original idea of the role. And But then I said, you know, there are some great sort of wonderful women that fit this prototype. And I said, Ming-Na Wen is an amazing actress, and I think she would fit that role. And I had been obviously a fan of hers forever. I feel like Mulan was the first time anything felt like it was talking to me as a young Asian child. And then, of course, Joy Luck Club. I said, oh my God, my relationship with my mother is so similar to what's experiencing here. And Ming was, you know, so wonderful in that film. And to this day, that's one of my favorite movies of all time, stories of all time. So I was over the moon when she agreed to come in and read and meet with us. And then as soon as she left the casting room, I turned to everybody. And I think Jeff Loeb remembers that. I was like, "This, it has to be her. That's it. It has to be her." And then we have to change the name. Yeah. She can't have the voice, but that part is her. I don't care what you say.
Wow.
And then as far as Chloe Bennett goes, we saw her. I think I saw her on Nashville, and I was so incredibly charmed by her. And I wasn't sure what her ethnicity was until I actually like Googled and looked into it. And I was like, oh my God, she's half Chinese. This is great. My mission is slowly being accomplished. She's absolutely incredible in the role. And, you know, it did take, with as with everything from all aspects of a show, it always takes some convincing of the powers that be. And we had three entities. We had ABC, we had Marvel, and then parent company, Disney, for them to sign off on everything. And so it was a long process, and we had to put Chloe through a lot of auditioning work, and she was down for it, and God bless her, because it won her the role. But with every character, with every move we make, with every word we write, we have to qualify it so many times, and I feel like that's just part of the process.
So worth it in those cases.
Mm-hmm.
We were curious also to discuss the recent wins and the importance of the writer's strike and the actor's strike as we move into 2024, hopefully with our best foot forward, with these historic negotiations advocating for better wages, better opportunities, better livelihoods for writers and actors across the board. From your perspective, why were these strikes so important, especially when you consider how challenging it is for minorities, for Asians, to find their big break and get their foot in the door?
So, just as a bit of context, as we delve into the subject of the Hollywood strikes, we wanted to speak specifically to the WGA strike, WGA being short for Writers Guild of America, which was historic in that it was the first since the writers' strike of 2007, and also that it was just over 5 months long, meaning a full halt to all work for guild members starting in May of 2023. It addressed a number of grievances that have become very topical with the paradigm shift of Hollywood's shift to streamers. And the writers' negotiations with the AMPTP, or Alliance of Motion Picture and Television Producers, was an advocacy for a major overhaul in compensation, streaming residuals, a solution to the increase of, quote, mini rooms, which are writers' rooms that are employing far fewer writers and therefore offering fewer employment opportunities, as well as coming up with language and restrictions regarding the threat of AI and its impact on future writer employment. The new 3-year agreement set in place as of October 2023 includes significant wins in the main areas writers had fought for, matching or nearly equaling what they sought out at the outset of the strikes. Let's hear what Marissa has to say about the writer strike impact.
I think the strike absolutely needed to happen. I know there are people who would argue otherwise, but I'll speak from just a writer's perspective. As I was saying earlier, before we started recording, the industry has shifted so much with the streaming domination of the way we consume all of the product that is being produced. And the business models have shifted, and we have been spending this time trying to catch up. And it was time to actually stop and define what we can from this point forward. And this is an ever-evolving thing. You know, even from when the strike was lifted to now, there have been things that have been discovered. I won't get into the nitty-gritty of that, but, you know, and then, of course, we have AI to consider. And although we set some parameters, that's an ever-evolving thing. So if anything, yes, the strike was necessary. I think for all writers of all backgrounds, and although, you know, I will say Asian writers represent a small percentage of the Writers Guild members, things have vastly improved as far as the content that is out there. And it makes me so happy to see. I think Crazy Rich Asians definitely sort of launched us in this direction as far as like recent times. Then I think they were, you know, people saw that, oh, this is a viable way to go. People are interested in Asian stories, or and it doesn't necessarily, it could just be a movie or a TV show with Asian faces that don't necessarily have to hit you over the head. That is the specificity of an Asian story. We exist in the world. And I think people are starting to recognize that. We exist like everybody else does. So it's nice that that's finally being recognized, but I would just like to see it being taken even further and to amplify that even more. And hopefully it continues to move in the right direction.
So as we delve into more discussion about Asian representation, we wanted to just provide some stats about the evolution of numbers over time. From a 2016 study from the Writers Guild of America West, it was noted that in 2014, Asians made up 2.9% of Guild members working in television. Per a study from USC's Annenberg Inclusion Initiative, when examining 1,600 films from 2007 to 2022, it was found that the percentage of Asian characters with speaking roles has gone from 3% to 16%. Definitely a step in the right direction. In 2022, the WGA Inclusion and Equity Report showed that over a 10-year period, women writers have gone from 29.3% of the writers employed to 45.3%, and BIPOC writers have increased from 13.6% of writers employed to 37%. We're happy to see that in recent years, writers from historically underrepresented groups have joined the WGA in growing numbers. That said, plenty of progress remains to be seen and hopefully awaits on the horizon.
I don't know if you ever went out on the line during the strike. Yeah, I feel like you did. Yeah. But it was always so nice when we had sort of the different committees within the guild. We would have specific meetups at different lots. And whenever it was the AAWC, the Asian American Writers Committee, it was so fun. And it seemed like there were a ton of us. So I was very pleased to see the amount of people that were there. And we were celebrating, even though it was a dire situation. Truthfully, I think the people who suffered the most, and it's awful and heartbreaking, is our crew.
Yeah.
All the people whose lives were halted on our behalf and their livelihoods halted on our behalf. And that was a very tough time. And we did as much fundraising as we could, and hopefully it helped, but you know, it's never enough. And so I'm just glad that we're back to work, and hopefully everyone is able to work again. And yeah.
We would love to pick your brain further about more on the current status of Asian representation in Hollywood and in media, and your experience with Asian representation over time. When do you feel like it dawned on you that Asian representation was lacking, or that it wasn't telling the full story, that real work had to be done in the world of Hollywood?
I think when I started officially, it was right after college. Like I always had an awareness as an audience, my entire life. But when I was actually starting to work in this business, you know, even entering the sort of workforce as a PA, I would look around and I would be the only one. Even as a, you know, as the person at the bottom of the totem pole, I would think there would be other women of color, people of color. For a very long time, I would be the only one in the room. And so that awareness was definitely present then. And then as I started to book jobs, I mean, the first script I sold was about two Asian American FBI agents. So it had to be specific to the way I looked and how I presented. Like even auditioning for voiceovers back in the day, it would always be, oh, she's an Asian actress, she has to be an Asian voice. And I was like, but that's not, you know, I barely speak Thai. I am fully an American person. You hear my voice, it you don't, you know, it's like, and anyways, now I'm starting to get angry, but we won't go there.
Feel free to, this is the space.
It's just called Dear Angry Asian Girl Podcast.
Dear Angry Asian Girls.
You should do like a spin-off, like Dear Angry
Totally. Asian Girl. Just, yeah, angry Asian Girl, Sad Asian Girl.
Yeah.
Righteous Asian Girl.
Yeah.
Well, this is a question I've been really curious to ask you about because it's one that I really have wrestled with in my own writing career, even just, you know, 5 years into like having representation. I feel like every year I am hit with a new paradigm shift that reveals some level of internalized shame within myself, yeah. Or I'm struck with a deeply healing experience that then might make me feel really sad for how long it's taken to see Parasite win with this stage full of Asians or whatever it might have been, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm curious how your relationship to your own Asianness and any internalized racism that so many of us face, how your relationship with your Asianness has evolved over time, especially as you've seen Hollywood undergo this trend toward, I'm putting trend in air quotes.
Hopefully it's not a trend.
Right.
Hopefully it just continues. I definitely felt a victory of sorts when Ming and when I would watch our show or be present in our show, shooting it and seeing Ming and Chloe there. That meant a lot to me. Just as a person, first and foremost, mm-hmm. and that those characters were embraced and beloved and never like their Asianness was never, in the forefront of who their characters were. It just, they are people, as we all are people, and we exist in the world, we are in the world. I know I said that already, but I think that's something that is starting to be understood in shows like Beef. You know, they are two disgruntled people for various reasons. They happen to have Asian faces. They happen to have an Asian experience, but the focus of the show is not that. Mm-hmm. Brother Son, which has been a huge hit. That's actually my brother. Shout out to Kevin Tantrone. He is he is a EP on that show, and he was a producing director, and he directed 5 out of the 8 episodes. And when he first told me about it, I was like, "Oh, okay, who's running that?" And he's like, "Brad Falchuk." And this young writer named Byron Wu. And I was like, Brad Falchuk? Oh, okay. But that's Brad's thing. You know, and I mad respect to him for that. Like, you know, look at Pose. I don't think he's had any experience, but he's interested in those stories. And so, mm-hmm. yeah, Byron Wu teamed up with him. And now we have a show that is all Asian faces and in front of the camera, in the writer's room, the directors, yes. even like a lot of the crew were all Asian American. And it was incredible. I went to that set and you could feel the joy. It was amazing. It was amazing. And now you witness their joy. I don't know if you follow them on social, but they definitely turned into, you know, one big happy family. And so
Oh gosh,
if they don't pick that up for season two, I give up. I'm actually gonna step away and go like start a lavender farm and like I don't know.
Take us with you. You know, that's all we have.
It makes no sense to me if it doesn't get a pickup. Yeah.
Yeah, it's such an achievement. I watched the pilot the other day. It was absolutely incredible. And when you get to see a project like that, like you said, obviously Asian actors in front of the camera, but we know that Asians were absolutely behind the camera. It is mm-hmm. without question healing. I feel it like on a cellular level, the level, of excitement, of being recognized. But like you said, when you went on set, I'm sure it was like tangible, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
To say it really matters is an understatement. It's life-changing. And I'm so excited to hear about the success of that show.
Absolutely, yeah. And also, you know, just the center of the show, of course, is the queen of all things, Michelle Yeoh.
Oh, and the icon.
She is so generous with her time and energy and just so gracious and wonderful. And so her presence there and her welcoming presence there just sort of permeated the whole experience from what I understand and from what I witnessed when I did go visit set. It's just super, super cool. A woman with her extensive experience and resume and, you know, how her career has evolved and just to have it coincide with an Oscar win, first of its kind, and then, you know, spearheading a show like this. I have hope. I do have hope for us in this.
I do too. It's hard not to.
Yeah.
It's hard not to when you watch a show like that, you know, it's so inspiring.
Nobody's Asian in the movie. Nobody's Asian in the movies kind of no longer applies. No. There you go.
So true.
Yeah. And I think you guys both touched on, at least for me, why I wanted to record this episode and why I had the idea to really talk about Asian representation behind the camera, behind film, because, I mean, the people we do see on the screen, we can see them, but how notable is it that there's Asian people behind the camera? There's diversity behind the camera, and we're mm-hmm. setting these spaces that are comfortable for people, that people feel like they can voice their opinions. They don't feel quiet. You know, that's so powerful to me. And I think that space only allows better creativity and more inspiration, which is, to me, it just makes me so excited to watch people kind of feed off of each other and, you know, have the feel like they can do that. So that was a big reason why I wanted to record this episode and talk to you about that especially. And as we've talked about throughout this whole episode, there's been notable growth in representation in the past 6 years, especially since Crazy Rich Asians. And there's began like a steady stream of increased Asian mainstream successes, such as Parasite, The Farewell, which I watched the trailer for that and I cried in the trailer. which hit me. And then especially Everything Everywhere All at Once, which the first time I watched it, like I could not get through it because it was just so... Like, how true is that, right? Like, yeah. It was almost too much for me. I felt it so much that I had to kind of stop and, like, recollect and then come back to it, which is one of the most powerful things ever. And obviously many more movies. We're still at a point where we need to see more diversity and representation for minorities on the screen. But the clear successes for a number of Asian movies and TV has shown us that there is an audience and a market that is interested in these stories. But even so, what areas of growth still remain in the system or otherwise in terms of continuing to help Asian creators flourish and get all the opportunities they deserve?
I think there needs to be more opportunities for Asian American female women directors. I just remember on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., when it came to hiring our directors, that was always sort of at the bottom of the list. And I think towards the end of our run, we improved upon that. But I just think as far as that goes in television, I think there needs to be more opportunities for Asian women directors. Yes. And also for the writers in the room, I just, you know, The Brother's Son is such a unique entity, because I know that they were like, no exceptions, everybody has to be, you know, and they did it. They did it, which is fantastic. Going into our next show, I really want to make that happen. So I think it's all up to people who are in positions like mine. It's also up to, I think we need more diversity in the executive realm, the people yeah. actually making the decisions. It would be great to have more Asian American female executives. And we, you know, at Netflix, there are a number in very big roles there, but more across the board.
More.
Yeah.
Yeah. And more on the great power of executives and whoever holds the decision-making power. I would like to ask, when an audience has feedback or opinions about Asian representation or representation in general, with you having worked behind the curtain with executives and studios, do people in power truly take audience feedback into consideration? And we're really curious about how our listeners and audience in general can exercise their own power and exercise their own influence to change Hollywood when they feel strongly about something. Because we understand that making sure we turn out for Asian content is huge, but how can our own opinions and voices be actually heard, if at all, by the Hollywood figureheads?
It is about numbers, and it is about unfortunately, it really is about the stats. You know, with new shows or movies that are put on streaming that are about Asian American stories, watch it. Binge it. Make sure you watch the whole thing. Watch all 8 episodes of The Brother's Son. Because that matters. It matters. They can tell if you just watch 1 or 2. It's about, So show up to the theaters. Try and do what you can to raise those box office numbers. It does matter. And then as far as, you know, put it out there on social media, your feelings about it, it is noted. It is noted that everybody looks at the good with the bad. And, you know, it's not a great idea to read bad reviews when you're in the middle of breaking a, you know, season of television. But, you know, it does matter. And executives and the powers that be that actually fund the making of your show are in tune with that. Mm-hmm. So do whatever you can to support. Yeah.
That's comforting to know. I think that our voices do count. Our time and attention absolutely counts. Just to bring us to a close, Marissa, we're so excited to hear if you're open to sharing with us just anything that you're currently working on or looking to work on, or anything that you're excited about in the coming year.
Oh my goodness. Well, it's so funny. Jed and I were just talking about this. The timing of S.H.I.E.L.D. ending, the last season airing, coincided with the pandemic. And we had various things in development right as S.H.I.E.L.D. ended, but it was a very strange time. My point being is we've been in endless development since, but on a handful of things, which is always good, but I'm ready to shoot something. I'm ready to actually be in production on one of the things. Something that I'm the most excited about is another musical that we've put together. And I do think this will be independently financed. I know people are going to be like, oh, is it Dr. Horrible too? But no, it is not. It's another original musical. And yes, I can't say much more about it, but I'm very excited about it. And
that's thrilling.
Yeah. And I will be in it as well, which is also exciting.
Oh
yeah.
My God.
I will tell you offline more about it.
Please.
And then we had developed a big IP with a certain studio and streamer for nearly 2 years now at this point. And it's a known IP. This is how it's been going. And we spent 2 years, and then post-strike, you know, it was sort of like a bloodbath. I'm talking about all the things that haven't gone, but the things that we're most excited about are the musical. We have another TV show. I can't be specific, so this is so vague and boring. But all the while, my like pet project, or my baby is I'm writing something deeply, deeply personal, which I'm also has me very scared of it. But it's along the lines of what you know our work to be, but this is just me. But it is genre, but it's more so about speaking about emotional experiences in metaphor, using genre elements. And it's about my whole, the lupus and all of it is wrapped in there. And right now it's coming out in both script form and prose. So it's very interesting what it'll end up being, but I have a feeling it's going to be, a series. And I'm excited about it because it is so personal. And there's intergenerational stuff in there, and, is that vague enough? I don't know.
Thank you for indulging us with those updates. And obviously we can't wait to be fans of each and every one of them and get to consume them and talk to you about them. That's really awesome.
I'm sorry, I can't say what
no I did not expect any details of any kind. Truly just wanted to have you indulge us on what you're excited about. So that's really cool.
So I got the chance to connect with Marissa more after our conversation, and we at Dear Asian Girl thought it was important to add regarding the big IP Marissa referenced. IP just means intellectual property, which is usually an existing entity, brand, or franchise. For example, Barbie the brand is the IP inspiring Barbie the film, Lego the brand inspired the Lego movie, etc. Marissa and her writing partner and husband, Jed Whedon, had indeed been working with a streamer on developing a series based off of a major source of IP for 2 years, churning out drafts of the show's pilot script or first episode. When Marissa said that the post-strike era was a bloodbath, this is just referring to the unfortunate cancellation of this project, and how this is an example of a casualty of the modern streaming culture and regime changes within that culture. That said, I was able to hear the premise of the show, which was so powerful and incredibly compelling. And it really is heartbreaking how even after years of hard work, events like this beyond writer's control can end the opportunity for a project to move forward. All this being said, I wanted to also add, Marissa and Jed, as of the time of this episode's recording, have a number of projects in development at various streamers, including Netflix and Peacock, which we are very excited to see unfold. And you can follow Marissa on Instagram at MoTancherone if you want to stay tuned on seeing what she's up to. Okay, back to the show.
The last thing that we'd love to know, Marissa, is what has been the hardest and or most important lesson that you've had to learn in the span of your careers and in your career? And how does that inform any advice you might have for the next generation of Asian writers?
I think as an artist, and all of you can relate to this, as an artist or specifically as a writer, you cannot be precious about anything. Writing and anything creative is an ever-evolving process and is fluid. So there's nothing ever set in stone. Even after your draft has gone to production, you know, there's a series of revisions, and even that final shooting script is never final, because on the day when you're on set and a certain scene that you had imagined this way, the location doesn't allow for that to play out in the way that you imagined. And so you have to pivot. And so it's just not about grasping onto things so tightly. You have to loosen your grip a little bit while still steering the ship and holding on to the original intention of the scene, the story, the show, but allowing yourself some fluidity, which I think is hard. I'm gonna say for me, it's hard for me, and I do think it's hard, like culturally, for us as Asian Americans to not have a sense of control, and something being kind of like finite and ready and prepared, and you kind of just gotta let it roll sometimes. I would say that has been a big lesson, as well as. I wish I had started out with the level of confidence I have now. I would have suffered much less pain and sadness throughout my career if I just understood that everyone's kind of winging it. Everyone feels this way. You are not by yourself. You do not have to be perfect all the time, and so you don't have to feel a lack of. Confidence because you just feel nervous about everything all the time. So I wish I had learned that, you know, in my college years. I wish I had learned that going into my first job. Would have saved me a lot of money in therapy, I think.
I think that lesson is one that you can only learn the hard way, right?
Yeah.
Of just learning gradually as you observe other people in your sphere that I totally deserve to be here.
Exactly.
I totally deserve to have a voice, you know, despite the conditioning and the messaging we receive as Asian women. It's a superpower to be exactly who you are. And the adversity that you face is also, if you can spindle that into the gold of being strong and having something to say and knowing what your significance is, that is just the greatest gift. And
couldn't
really
have said it better. Couldn't have said it better, Lindsay. Exactly.
Thank you so much, Marissa. We were all so looking forward to this conversation, and we wanted to thank you sincerely for all that you've done to pave the path for women, for people like us, for everything you've done to champion Asian women in your career. You are an inspiration, you are a badass, and you are such a gift to all who know you, and we could not be more grateful.
This is like pot calling the kettle. Is that the saying?
Right.
See, this is what happens when you have immigrant parents, like all the sort of idioms and sayings, I just get them all.
Something about a kettle and a pot. That's all I got.
Anyways, thank you so much for those
thank
kind
you.
Words. I'm very honored that you invited
the
me.
The honor is ours. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Marissa. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
As this episode comes to a close, we'd like to shout out the rest of our team who you don't hear from as often as us co-hosts. Their contributions are integral to the smooth running of Dear Asian Girl, and we would hate to take all the credit for what is truly a huge team effort.
Annika, May, Pavani, Yalda, Anya, and Michaela are our researchers, and Sonia is our audio engineer.
Emma, Prisha, and Claire are our social media writers. Chloe, Kaylee, and Nicole are our social media illustrators.
Alex is our social media manager, and Annette is our podcast manager.
And finally, Ellie is our podcast director. Thanks, team. We couldn't do it without you.